tonight, before I begin today's subject, which is Quaker worship, say a word or two about one or two other matters. First place, you'll find that you got pretty good grades in the last quiz, which means the reading was easier, the questions were easier, or you did good work. I'm not sure which. But I warn you that today's reading isn't perhaps quite as easy. I mean, this week's reading is not quite as easy. I want to say a word about the origin of the term Quaker. George Fox leads you to believe that Justice Bennett at Derby, and I suppose you know that E before R in England is pronounced by, like A. Do you recognize that? If you have a clerk, what we call a clerk, then England's a clerk. And so Derby is Darby. And actually spelled that way in Pennsylvania, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
So that I'm not mispronouncing. I'm really saying that Justice Bennett, when Fox was in trouble at Derby, called them Quakers, Fox and his associates, on the ground that they told the judges to tremble at the word of the Lord. Now, that origin of the word is not unanimously supported. Other early friends said it represented the shaking and trembling which took place in a Quaker gathering as a result of the emotional strain. And I think there's a good deal of evidence that they did, like other religious people, show their emotion by physical, shall I say, by abnormal physical behavior. Shall I say, involuntary and abnormal physical behavior. Now, a third I would add to that, beside these two possible explanations. Are they called Quakers because they told other people to quake, or were they called Quakers because they quaked themselves? I would add that we have apparently good evidence before the rise of Quakerism, of the name as a nickname for certain religious fanatics in two documents dated in 1647. I've looked at many references to the word Quaker that professed to be dated before 1650 is the Derby date, but they've nearly all been mistakes. But these two there at Oxford, I've looked at carefully, and it would seem as though there's a genuine pre-Quaker use of the name for some other fanatic. So it may be that when Justice Bennett made this comment, he had already heard the name elsewhere. I don't know. I simply raise that question, because I think the reading in Rufus Jones is a little confusing on that point. Well, now, friends, today we've got a subject which some of you know something about, namely a Quaker meeting for worship. I don't distinguish it from other subjects entirely, but at least many of you have been exposed to this, unfortunately, in the most unpropitious way, by compulsory attendance. I want to talk about it as a feature of Quakerism, a voluntary, whereas the shaking, the quaking, may be involuntary. I will say the worship is voluntary. One that goes back to the earliest time. And therefore, before we move on in date, I want to talk about this and another early feature of Quakerism, the way they hold their worship and the way they hold their business meetings. That I'll deal with on Friday. As far as we can tell, this way of worshiping is as old as the beginning of Quakerism. And naturally, one raises the question whether, like some other features of early Quakerism, it wasn't anticipated by other groups. It may well be, although I can't indicate. I would think, for example, that the Seekers, whose character we know, when they met, would have met as seekers and not with a program of a worship service. And I think they would wait in silence and would listen to God, as they would say, or for what God might speak to the group through an individual member. That, at any rate, is the philosophy of the typical Quaker meeting, held in silence, without program, and with vocal participation, only spontaneous and not premeditated in general. I suppose you could say that the most conspicuous thing about Quaker worship are the things it doesn't have. No consecrated building. No order of service. No presiding officer. Shall I say, no human presiding officer. The philosophy was that a superhuman being, the presence of Christ or God, was the presiding officer. No pulpit, no reading or singing or music. No choir, no stained glass windows, no elaborate decorations, no sacramental act like breaking bread and drinking wine. In fact, no liturgy. Shall I add, no collection? I remember the little boy who first went to a friend's meeting. He said, it doesn't cost nothing, ain't worth nothing. That's the modern economic approach. The fabric of the meeting is collective silence. And out of the silence, voluntary and spontaneous speaking open to any member of the meeting, not to a limited group or to a single individual. Sometimes these meetings are called silent meetings. They're not always silent. Sometimes they're all silent, but not regularly so. And it is appropriate that there should be speaking, but it comes out of the silence. A better description of them is worship on the basis of silence, or speaking on the basis of silence. Well, now this kind of worship was as unique in Protestantism then as it is now. I don't know where else you will go in the Western world to find this kind of religious phenomenon. And I don't know where else you would have gone in 17th century England to find it, unless it be, as I say, some of the Seekers. There might have been some precedent there. This silence offended the opponents of Quakerism. You can make people pretty mad by keeping quiet. And they did. The official rule was, when laws were passed against the conventicles, that all worship had to be after the manner of the Church of England. Well, this wasn't. Obviously it wasn't. And therefore they were caught and arrested if they worshipped in this way. Of course, when they spoke, as they usually someone did, that was obviously not according to the liturgy of the Church of England. So they could be arrested for that. On the other hand, somewhat baffled persecutors, because they hung around to see if somebody would speak. Oftentimes, nobody would. Well, who are you going to arrest? The whole meeting? Of course, if somebody speaks, you'll arrest him, won't you? He'd be the obvious person to arrest. And you'll arrest the person in whose house it's held. That was a penalty. Let anybody even worship in your house. And these meetings were in private houses, usually. Certainly not in any church building. And people took not legal offense, but personal offense at the place of meeting. They were used to a consecrated building. They didn't think you could worship God in an ordinary house. And here the Quakers were meeting in houses, or meeting in the hayloft of a barn, or meeting in an orchard or a meadow, outdoors somewhere. When their meeting houses were destroyed or locked by the police, they would meet right there on the ruins, in the street, in front, or on the ruin. So that, well, to tell the truth, it's a very economical form of religion. You don't have to pay a preacher, and you don't have to have an elaborate house. In fact, you can meet in any house. A great many of the newest and strongest Quaker meetings are still meeting in a borrowed or hired room, but not a built house. And in the early days, I don't find that the Quakers built any meeting houses for the first 20 or 30 years. In time, they did. And they built them in this country when they became strong enough. So that there came to be what were called meeting houses. They were licensed under English law when it was legitimate, and they were a prominent feature of the community where there were many friends. The meeting house, the schoolhouse, and the graveyard, often on the same lot, three of them, were the center of a Quaker community, and often provided before even all the settlers had any decent homes of their own. In southeastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey, a great many meeting houses were built when they were settled, and they are notable in the architectural history of America, of colonial America.